On Perspective this week, we hear from local historian John Manley about his research into the history of Ballymona Hospital. John, you're the author of Ballymona Hospital, The Complete History, with the subtitle Modernising Mental Health Care on the Isle of Man. What brought you to this topic? Because you're a fairly prominent historian, local historian now. You've written a couple of books. Is it two or three books?
This is the fourth book, yeah. Phil, all written when I retired from my full-time career in law and studied at UCM to obtain a degree in history and heritage, and that in recent years led me into writing local history books. So as I say, this is the fourth book in the line so far. I tend to pick stories, Phil, that haven't been told before. Mm. And to answer your question, that's what led me into writing this latest book on Ballymona Hospital. Amazingly, although it had a 130-year history, Phil, no one had ever previously written the story of Ballymona Hospital, and friends and relatives mentioned to me this fact, and it piqued my interest. And so at the start of this year, I began to research the topic, and fortunately found for my readers that there was a large amount of archival material stored on the island which had never been explored. And so I began my research at the start of the year, Phil, and eventually in the middle of the year began writing the book that we have today.
And I suppose a strange place to start, but it's a place I'll try and encourage you to look at, is before there was a Ballymona Hospital, what was the situation on the island?
The situation was quite wild, actually, Phil, for those suffering from mental illness. There was no proper care or treatment anywhere on the island. The book mentions some horrific stories, true stories, of mentally ill people on the island, all over the island, being chained up to walls or to barn floors in disgraceful conditions. They were in rags. They were fed on the offal that the animals refused to eat. If they weren't chained up by relatives, they were wandering the streets of Douglas or the country roads of the Isle of Man, wearing more often than not nothing more than a shirt to keep them from the elements. It was quite a distressing sight at the time, Phil. And the Isle of Man sadly lagged behind the rest of Britain in its treatment of such people.
And you have, as your first illustration in the book, the new Bethlehem Asylum in London. Maybe I should have known this before now, but the new Bethlehem was Bedlam.
Yes, the modern word, and it's in the dictionaries nowadays, the modern word Bedlam derived from New Bethlehem, which was the first state designed full-time asylum for mentally ill people in London, in fact in the whole of England. It was a shocking place, Phil. Although it was designed to house mentally ill people, it actually became some kind of grotesque circus. Mm. People were able to walk to Bedlam from nearby London, and they went on a day out to mock and deride the inmates of Bedlam for a small charge. It was a terrible place, Phil. There's a photograph in the book, early in the book, of one of the more famous inmates who's sketched, actually chained to his bed in Bedlam. It was a shocking place, Phil, but it was the first step in providing somewhere for a permanent home for mentally ill people in England. And that was long before the Isle of Man, unfortunately, got around to thinking about the same line of inquiry.
Yes, it looks, I'm trying to do a bit of mental maths here just to work it out, but it's getting on towards a century before we then opened a similar institution in the island.
Yes, there was nothing on the Isle of Man, Phil, until a temporary asylum was opened at Oatlands Farmhouse in Sandton in 1864, which was 4 years before the permanent asylum. And I use these terms correctly, Phil. They are historic terms, and to some modern way of people think that they may sound. I should have said that right at the start, Phil, that some of the terms I'm going to mention may sound derisive and insulting in modern terminology. I don't mean to offend anybody by using certain terms. They're correct medical terms that were used by doctors at the time. So asylum was the first name for what later became Ballymona Hospital. In fact, the full title was Isle of Man Lunatic Asylum. And strangely, Phil, a sandstone carving with the words Lunatic Asylum remained on the central water tower at Ballymona Hospital right up until its demolition in 1998.
From the first attempt in the 1860s then, how long was it after that before Ballymona Hospital was finally established?
Yeah, the permanent lunatic asylum was established in 1868, Phil. But the shocking state of affairs before that existed from 1800 onwards. There was a period from 1815 onwards when mentally ill people were actually incarcerated in Castle Rushen Jail. And they were incarcerated there with criminals and debtors, and they freely mingled. All of these categories of detainee freely mingled within the walls of Castle Rushen. So someone suffering from a mild case of mental illness could be freely associating in Castle Rushen, and this is no exaggeration, with a criminal murderer, Phil.
Yeah, and I don't imagine there would have been an awful lot of sympathy for either from the prison guards.
Well, no. Well, there wasn't a lot of supervision, full stop, from the prison guards, Phil. When the jail first opened in 1815, there were only four staff. And no one observed the prisoners and the mentally ill people during the night. It was as simple as that. They were left to their own devices, certainly for the 8 hours of night time, and probably much longer than that. So it was a terrible state of affairs. Now that we look back in the 21st century to think that this state of affairs existed on the island only 200 years ago, it's quite remarkable, Phil.
Absolutely. So what was the I don't know, the thinking, who was doing the pushing to actually establish the new hospital, the new Ballymona
Hospital?
That's
a good question, Bill. And there were various various prompts to the Isle of Man government, as you'll know from your own personal history, Phil. Up until the mid-1860s, the Isle of Man government was self-elected. And on the question of social welfare, they were very slow to act. They had to be, as your question suggests, they had to be pressured into eventually doing something about the state of the mentally ill on the island. And the pressure came from various sources. It came from some educated gentlemen, and I say educated because they were able to read and write, and therefore they could converse with the press on the Isle of Man, which had existed since 1792. So they, these philanthropic gentlemen, and they were mainly gentlemen in those times, they wrote to the local newspapers expressing their dissatisfaction with the existing state of mental illness on the island. The pressure also came on the Manx government from the English government, who had introduced early in the 19th century legislation of their own forcing counties in England to introduce asylums of their own. And they saw through the Lieutenant Governor, the representative on the island, the English government could see the state of affairs on the island. So the pressure came from the UK Home Secretary. And it also came, finally, Phil, from a board known as the UK Commissioners in Lunacy, which was based in London and looked after the running of the county asylums throughout England. They had no formal power on the Isle of Man, but they were certainly an influence on the island's governor. And from all those directions, Phil, the pressure eventually paid off. The Manx government finally, and only in 1860, introduced a Lunacy Act on the Isle of Man, which mentioned in it that the Isle of Man would consider constructing a permanent full-time asylum for mentally ill people. And they only did that because the UK government promised to pay half of the cost of such an asylum.
Gosh. and how much would half the cost have been back then?
Estimates vary, Phil, but we're talking about £15,000 in total in contemporary figures, and of that the UK government paid its half, round about £7,500.
Yes, well, and it sounds like a drop in the ocean compared with the sort of money that's being spent now, but we're talking, well, a good 150 years ago now, aren't we? So I guess £7,500 would have been a fair amount of money in modern terms.
Yes, it would, Phil. But that's how the permanent asylum at the Strang came about. But because the pressure had become so intense by the early 1860s, from all of these directions mentioned earlier, the Isle of Man government also had to consider erecting a temporary asylum in the meantime. And as mentioned, they did convert a farmhouse at the Oatlands farm in Sandton into a temporary asylum from 1864 to 1868. This asylum initially housed round about 30 mentally ill people. It also housed some of the criminally insane from Castle Rushen itself. But the numbers rapidly increased of the patients at the temporary asylum. The figures very quickly doubled, and it soon became obvious that the need for the permanent asylum was ever increasing.
Hmm. So I mean, if they starting off at around 30 and it doubles, that's an awful lot of people to fit into a farmhouse, isn't it?
Yes, it must have been pretty awful, to be frank. The conditions at the farmhouse even were described by a local doctor as wholly inadequate. But it was a temporary solution because whilst the temporary asylum was open, of course, work had begun up at the Strang. The estimates had been approved, and the work had been awarded to London architect Henry Christian, who had many connections, family connections on the Isle of Man. So while the temporary asylum was open, Mr. Christian and his works foreman and local builders, Richard Cowell and his brother, began work on the permanent asylum at the Strang. But it took them the best part of 4 years to finish the project.
And presumably, with all great government works, there would have been a grand opening, was there?
There was. In 1868, there was a grand opening in May of that year. And various notable people on the Isle of Man wrote to the local newspapers congratulating the Manx government on finally achieving the end result. It was a joyous time on the island that the mentally ill finally had a permanent place to reside where they would receive proper care and attention. Local high bailiffs, magistrates, were requested to round up, for want of a better description, those mentally ill persons still wandering the streets and countryside of the Isle of Man, and they were all eventually transferred to what later became Ballymona Hospital.
And what did proper care look like in those early years?
Again, it is a very unsatisfactory situation, Phil. None of the original staff, apart from the medical superintendent, were medically qualified. There was a right hoo-ha on the island over the medical superintendent's appointment. The first medical superintendent was Dr. Tregellis Hingston, and he had come from an asylum in the UK, and local people and local politicians felt that local doctors might have been more suitable, and of course that they might have been employed at something of a lesser salary. But nevertheless, Dr. Hingston was appointed and became the first British medical superintendent of Ballymona Hospital. But under him, the attendants, as they were known in those days, both female and male, had no medical qualifications whatsoever. The patients were fed regularly, morning, evening and night, in the main dining hall, which, for those who can remember the old Ballymona building, was in the ground floor centre of the original building. The patients all had their own beds, so they were fed, they had somewhere to sleep, reasonably warm and comfortable. Of course, it was the days of coal fires in each room were the only heating system available, but a coal fire as opposed to the wind and rain of Roman countryside must have been a welcome development for the patients. So I suppose you could say, Phil, that the quality of treatment initially was rudimentary, but far much of an improvement on what had existed before.
The sort of people that would be ending up in there, what levels of mental illness are we talking about?
We're talking about mental illness right across the spectrum, Phil. We're talking about people who were mentally ill because they overindulged in alcohol, for instance. But then we're talking about people who were epileptics, right across the spectrum to people who had maniacal dispositions and incurable maniacs, as they were known in those days. So to answer your question, right across the spectrum, Phil, we're talking about. But we also had people in there, as you would assume from the description I've just given, we had people in there who probably shouldn't have been in a hospital of any description, but there was simply nowhere else for them to go, Phil.
So then it's been established. What other features about the early years of the establishment are noteworthy from your research?
Yes, the blueprint for the mental asylum came from asylums mainly in England and Scotland. And their asylums, as I mentioned earlier, had begun to originate from the 1810s onwards. So there were blueprints from the English system which were copied by Mr. Christian, of course, the architect. He was familiar with the designs of England asylums. And so Ballymona was very much designed along those lines. For example, the situation was chosen to be an agricultural site with open fields and a farm and plenty of air and light and away from the main centres of population to give patients the freedom and ability to be able to exercise and breathe in fresh country air. So that was the original design, Phil. Agriculture became a major part of the daily life at the lunatic asylum. Many patients indulged in agriculture during the working day. It was seen by medical practitioners of the time as a kind of therapy for them. But it also, of course, Phil, helped the medical superintendent and his staff keep control of the patients. And there was some criticism of this system from some quarters. As this system progressed both in the Isle of Man and in England, because some commentators saw that or believed that patients were being used as some kind of cheap labour on these asylum estates. And it is true, undoubtedly true, that patients contributed to the output of the asylum farms. They helped plant the fields, they helped look after the asylum animals, and they eventually assisted with the asylum produce. So arguments were made that this was a very dubious system, to be frank.
But I imagine it would be quite a therapeutic thing as well for the patients to be able to go out and enjoy the countryside and be out in the fresh air, and looking after animals, doing all those sorts of things. It's certainly from my experience anyway. I mean, I haven't had mental illness as such, but it's a great therapeutic place to be out in the countryside.
Yes, and that's how every single medical superintendent who came to the Isle of Man, most of the medical superintendents, if not all, in fact, apart from the last superintendent, Dr. Castaigne, who was born on the island, as you may know, most of the medical superintendents came from England or Scotland, or Ireland, actually. And they all believe that there was a form of therapy in the patients working on the land. Mm. But as I say, it wasn't without its criticism, Phil.
There's a fascinating title to Chapter 5, The Great War Years and Dr. Finnegan's Amazing Marriage Pact. Tell us about that.
Dr. Arthur Finnegan was an Irish doctor who came to the island's mental institution in 1916. He was given sole responsibility for looking after the island's asylum during the First World War years. But before he came to the island, Dr. Finnegan had worked in asylums in Ireland, and in one particular asylum in Ireland, he had met his future wife, Eleanor. Eleanor was initially, a nurse in an asylum, but she later trained at Trinity College in Dublin to become a doctor herself. And she went on to train further at Aberdeen University. She then worked abroad as a doctor in Serbia and also finally worked in Sheffield in England as a doctor. But the couple had devised a written document when they had first married in Ireland because Mrs. Finnegan did not want children to interrupt her medical work. And Dr. Arthur Finnegan had signed this document to say that he and his wife would have no intimate relationship. In other words, the marriage was never consummated. And in 1917, Dr. Arthur Finnegan took his case to a divorce court. But the divorce judge had no sympathy with either Dr. Finnegan or his wife. The judge would not interfere or order a judgment in either case, or in either favour. He simply left them to their own devices. He had no sympathy with Dr. Finnegan because he'd entered into this agreement knowing that it was unlikely to be consummated. And similarly, the judge had no sympathy with Mrs. Finnegan because she had agreed to this document in the first place. So the judge refused to grant the divorce in either direction. And to conclude that story, Phil, it is true that Mrs. Finnegan was not long of this world, and she died shortly afterwards, but she was buried in the cemetery at the Irish Asylum where she'd first met Dr. Finnegan. And 30 years later, when Dr. Finnegan died, he was buried alongside her.
Gosh, well, quite an amazing story, really. You move on then in the chapters, you talk about the Skeen years. Who was Skeen? Another doctor, presumably?
Dr. Leslie Skeen came to the island. He was a Scottish doctor who came to the island in 1922. And he was one of the longest-serving medical superintendents at what later became Ballymona Hospital. He served there up until 1947. Dr. Skeen was a remarkable man. He was a sportsman who played football for Queen's Park football team in Scotland, but he also played in goals for Fulham FC in London for many years. And he was capped as an international goalkeeper by Scotland. But he also had an interest in cricket, and both football and cricket he got involved in when he came to the Isle of Man in 1922. But he was a remarkable man. He was an outspoken man on various medical subjects. But apparently, from accounts of people he worked with, staff he worked with, he was well liked and respected.
And we've kind of lost track a little bit of the patients in the last few bits of the interview. Had things improved by the time we got through to the, I suppose, round about the time of the Second World War for the patients?
Yes, things had dramatically improved for the patients themselves, Phil. Private donors had always, from the beginning of the 20th century, they'd always donated privately to the hospital to improve the patients' conditions. For example, there was a library, there were newspapers, magazines, there were outings for the patients. There was an annual charabang outing around the island. The patients also went to the theatres in Douglas to view productions locally. And there were many visiting bands and orchestras to the asylum itself. Food had improved, the quality of food had improved for the patients, the quality of their accommodation improved, and the quality of staff at the asylum improved. For example, around about 1920, the staff began to become fully medically qualified. The nurses began, for example, to take professional examinations on a par with nurses in England. So for all those reasons, Phil, up to the Second World War, the quality of life for the patients had increased immeasurably.
So then we get to the end of wartime uniforms, it says here, and the arrival of televisions. That presumably is, well, obviously late 40s, early 1950s.
Yes, probably into the 50s, Phil. But I mention the wartime uniforms because it's worth going back a fraction in time there, because we should, of course, mention that during the First World War and the Second World War, many local internees were treated at Ballymona Hospital, or the mental hospital as it was known. Then they were treated as patients. And also, it should be mentioned, both Manx and British service personnel were treated at the island's mental institution. So in the two world wars, Phil, there was a dramatic increase during both times in the numbers of patients in the hospital. And it must be said that particularly the alien detainees brought many new problems for the medical superintendent and his staff. And it's quite obvious from some of the comments from the medical superintendents that they found looking after these alien detainees rather difficult and stressful.
And was that a language thing, or was it something more than that?
No, well, it was more than that. One particular medical superintendent comments that these alien detainees were more violent and more obstructive to medical treatments and to following medical instructions.
Okay. And well, the wartime uniform thing then, what was that all about?
Yes, that's just a simply mention that the wartime uniforms that had appeared in the mental hospital after 1945, when all the service personnel were repatriated, the military uniforms began to disappear from the surroundings of the mental hospital, and into the 1950s, televisions, like they did into many households in the United Kingdom and in the island, they began to make their way into the mental hospital for the patients' use.
And then we get into the 1960s, and the final superintendent, Dr. Castaigne, who is probably still reasonably well known on the island.
Dr. Roy Castaigne was born in Calpe, down your neck of the woods, I believe, Phil. But he trained in England as a doctor, and he joined the Royal Navy and actually served as a medic in the Royal Navy all over the world, including notably in Hong Kong. And he also served as a medic on the Royal Navy ship that attended the wedding of Prince Rainier and Grace Kelly, the film star, in Monaco. But eventually, around about 1965, Phil, Dr. Castaigne made his way back to his beloved Isle of Man and was appointed medical superintendent at the Strang Hospital. He was probably the last holder of that title, medical superintendent, because as we moved into the 70s and the 80s, Phil, the term medical superintendent tended to disappear, and more recent holders of the title were known as principal nursing officers, or indeed matron, and that included the male matrons.
Right, okay. And yes, so we're now, I suppose, into the 1970s. I mean, was there radical change at this time?
Yes, there was, Phil. The radical change began in the 1960s when Enoch Powell was the Minister for Health in the United Kingdom. And to cut a long story short, he had decided that the days of keeping patients in mental institutions were fast coming to an end. His belief was that mentally ill patients should be cared for in the community. He was heavily criticised at the time for this move because his opponents saw it as a means of simply affecting drastic cuts in the mental health provision in the United Kingdom. But nevertheless, his policy prevailed and it became known both in the United Kingdom and the Isle of Man as care in the community. In a nutshell, patients were simply moved out of mental institutions into various new arrangements in the community. In the Isle of Man, this took the form initially of moving patients out of Ballymona Hospital into boarding houses in Douglas, where the boarding house keepers agreed to look after these patients. It was at a time, Phil, you'll remember, the 1970s, when tourism numbers on the island began to decrease because of package holidays abroad. And so boarding house keepers were more than welcome to accept this new form of custom. It wasn't always successful. Certain boarding house keepers were better at it than others. But that was the first transition into care in the community. And that policy has lasted now, Phil. It's still in place into modern day Manx healthcare. And there's a great debate we could probably have for another day as to whether that's been successful or not. Some commentators say it has, and they give their reasons. Some commentators, however, say it hasn't, and they give their reasons.
Then I suppose we're heading towards the end of the 20th century, and indeed the end of Ballymona Hospital. When did the hospital actually close formally?
Well, it closed and it was demolished in 1998, Phil. The Manx government had decided, along with the government in the United Kingdom, that the new policy of care in the community should be introduced, and they saw the days of the old mental asylums as being something of the past. Government planners at the time even went so far as to refuse the local Victorian Society's plea to preserve the central block of Ballymona Hospital, if nothing else. Government planners had decided that the whole of Ballymona Hospital should go to make way for the new General Nobles Hospital, which exists today, Phil. So that's what happened through the machinations of various politicians, including Bernard May and Claire Christian. Ballymona Hospital was demolished and Nobles General Hospital came into existence on the same site.
And then I suppose, well, in your chapters you then have an epilogue, and presumably that's a reflection as to what's happened in the quarter of a century since the demolition of the hospital.
That's exactly it, Phil. And I include in the epilogue my own thoughts on the matter. We have reached a situation in the Isle of Man today, Phil, where mentally ill patients are today being sent off the Isle of Man to institutions in England for two reasons. A, it's cheaper to send them to the United Kingdom for treatment. And B, we don't have the capacity on the Isle of Man to look after them on the island. The only remaining acute mental health facility on the island is at the island's Mananin Court, alongside Nobles General Hospital. They have approximately 30 beds, Phil, to cater for all acute mentally ill patients on the island. It's simply not enough. Not only that, the Isle of Man today is actually sending off island young mentally ill people for the same reason we haven't got the facilities to treat them on island, Phil. Ballymona Hospital was no panacea. It had its problems. But one has to ask oneself whether the situation we have today is better than it was 30 years ago. We seem to have gone back now, Phil, to doing things that we were doing on the island 200 years ago. We're sending mentally ill patients off the island. 200 years ago, when there was no asylum on the island, private wealthy individuals would sponsor mentally ill people to go to institutions in Liverpool and Dublin and Scotland. And now it's state-sponsored. We're sending them off the island because we simply haven't got the capacity to cater for them on island. So one has to question that. The young people situation on island, Phil, is even more worrying. The CAMHS setup that exists on the island is overstretched, overburdened and understaffed. Young people on the island are waiting 6 to 12 months for an assessment for their mental health, Phil. That's quite scandalous. All of those months that they're waiting to be assessed, their mental conditions are deteriorating. Previously, from 1953 onwards at Ballymona Hospital, there existed a children's villa where children's mental illness of all descriptions would be looked after. Now, families, the police, taxi drivers, shopkeepers are asked to look after mentally ill people because we simply haven't got sufficient facilities on the island to look after them, Phil. We have to ask ourselves, was the situation at Ballymona better than the situation that we have today? It certainly wasn't perfect, but we certainly haven't got a perfect situation today, Phil.
Well, sadly, we're almost at the end of the programme now, so I suppose a relatively short answer. On the whole, Ballymona Hospital, good thing or bad thing?
Well, as I've just explained, Phil, one could argue that it was a good thing in that access to Ballymona on the island was immediate. It was available 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. It certainly wasn't perfect, but everybody with a mental problem had somewhere they could go, and it was on island, Phil. We have to think about not just the patients here, patients and their families. Patients and their families today, as well as in the days of Ballymona Hospital, surely would have preferred for island mental patients to stay on the island rather than be dispatched to various institutions around the United Kingdom. It's no help whatsoever for someone with a mental illness to be dispatched away from loved ones on the island. So you could certainly mount a strong argument to say that the days of Ballymona Hospital, albeit they were not perfect, there was always a place to go on the island, there was always a bed at Ballymona Hospital. There aren't the beds now on the island that there once were. And people are at a loss when they suffer from mental illness today.
And of course, there's so much more that people can find out about Ballymona Hospital in this wonderful book that you've written. Ballymona Hospital, The Complete History, Modernising Mental Health Care and the Isle of Man. Now, where can people acquire this book?
This book, which has fortunately been selling very well, Phil, is still available in all Manx bookshops. Or if anyone can't make it to a Manx bookshop, they can email me directly, johnmanley58@hotmail.com.
That was local historian John Manley. Don't forget this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn. Gunnar Myers and Geisa Grum. Thanks for listening.